This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/youandyours. Last week on You and Yours, we discussed peak oil, the point when the world's oil and gas supplies will reach their peak and then begin an irreversible decline. It will happen, obviously. Indeed, some experts believe it already has. But how will we cope in a world that can no longer rely on cheap and plentiful supplies of the one commodity, oil, that keeps it going? Because everything virtually, from food supplies to transport to manufacturing, relies on oil. And there are some very drastic predictions on how things will have to change. It's something I've been discussing with Richard Heinberg, senior fellow of the Post Carbon Institute in California and author of The Party's Over and several other books about peak oil. John Hemming chairs the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Peak Oil and Gas, and Matt Simmons has been advisor to President Bush on the issue in his capacity as CEO of one of the world's largest energy investment banks, Simmons & Co.
Over the last 10 to 15 years, the data has been pouring in that we were nearing the inflection point, and the only argument for anybody seriously looking at the data is when was the tipping point. Unfortunately, about 90% of the people hearing the argument didn't have a vaguest clue even what it meant, and so we basically passed the tipping point.
And when you've been asked before if it's time, you know, for this whole idea of peak oil and gas to become part of the public policy debate, you've said it's past time, and in fact the solution now is to pray. Is it really as dire as that?
I believe so, and I think the data is overwhelmingly, it's not perfect yet. It won't be until we look back with you know, the benefit of 2 or 3 year hindsight. But I think the data is pretty clear that we basically, you know, reached this sustainable top oil production in 2005. So we're now 3 years beyond the tipping point.
Richard Heinberg, how will our lives have to change as a result of this?
Well, profoundly and in all sorts of ways. We use oil for transportation. Obviously, about 95% of our transport energy is from oil. But also agriculture is overwhelmingly dependent on petroleum. In industrial countries, for every calorie of food that we produce, we expend about 10 calories of fossil fuel energy. So our entire food system is dependent on oil. And then plastics and chemicals of all kinds. So our lives are going to be profoundly impacted in all directions. But certainly transportation is going to be the first and most powerful impact. We don't know how to fly planes without petroleum, for example.
How can we cope, too, with an ever-increasing population? Because in 2020, the world population is predicted to be double what it was in 1980. But, of course, if you're right, if we have either reached or will soon reach the oil peak, then production will likely be much less.
We're not talking about all oil going away overnight. We're talking about a gradual reduction in available oil. That by itself is very serious because we've been used to having more with every passing year. The growth in human population happened because we had cheap energy with which to produce more food, with which to transport resources from where they were abundant to where they were scarce. And so now in the new era of more expensive and more scarce fuel and energy, we're going to have to rethink just about everything we do.
Are we talking about population control at some point?
Well, certainly we're going to have to look at how to reduce population increase and perhaps even contemplate ways to reduce fertility so that gradually the human population can contract back to a level that we can sustain. Obviously, we want to do this in the most humane ways without disregarding human rights. But at the same time, the ecological reality is we may not be able to support 7, 8, or 9 billion people.
Matt Simmons, do you really think we're going to have population control as a result of your fears over peak oil?
I think population control is like introducing a new car. It's a great concept, but basically it just takes too long. We don't have the time for these. We would have had the time if we started thinking about this in the 70s or 80s. But again, population control, unless we're talking about genocide, takes decades to implement. So, liberating the workforce and allowing people to work when they want and where they want, growing food locally, ending globalization, making things where you use them can be implemented in 3 to 4 years. So that's the sort of draconian measures we need to do. And long term, we need to think about these other things. But they're very long term implementations, and we don't have that time. We ran out the clock.
As chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on this, John Hemming, do you agree with this doomsday scenario?
I think that there are different perspectives as to the impact of the peak, which is around about now, yes. I think we need to recognise, for instance, that there is a link between food and energy. Fertilisers are generally the feedstock is from oil, so you will always have the link between the two. And the policy changes that are needed are the same whether you agree with the doomsday scenario or not. We still need to be much more orientated towards controlling the use of fossil fuels.
And is the government currently doing that? Is it doing as much as it not only could but should, desperately should, according to Matt and Richard? Do you think it is?
I think the government's not even doing as much as it intends to. The first problem from the government is denial. They estimate the peak, global peak for hydrocarbon production as being 2030. They explain that's based on the IEA's figures, and the IEA perhaps indicate a figure of 2011-2012. If you start by denying there is a problem, then it's not surprising they're not doing anything about it.
So what should they be doing, John?
There's a wide range of things. We're producing a number of reports, but the fact that you cannot, for instance, have a third runway at Heathrow Airport is a very obvious thing. They plan for a growth in air transport. It's a farce to plan for a growth in air transport when there isn't actually the fuel to power it.
Richard, of course, the UK government's not alone in this. I've read some of your writings. You say a lot of governments around the world, perhaps the majority, are like a rabbit frozen in the headlights. It is such an enormous problem, they don't quite know how to respond, so at the moment they're not responding. But what hope is there, Richard? I mean, what about alternatives like fossil fuels, like renewables? If you could combine them in some way and really bring them on stream, are they a possible solution?
Well, of course, we do need to develop alternative sources of energy as quickly as possible. And this is going to be an enormous task. It's going to require the investment of hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars over many years. But the reality is we're not going to be able to bring these alternative energy sources on stream fast enough to replace depleting petroleum. So our main tactic is going to have to be learning how to live with less. We could be driving cars that are much more fuel efficient, there's no question. And of course, if we had better public transport, that would reduce the energy intensity of our transport system immensely. But again, these things take time and investment. It's not going to happen overnight.
John Hemming, what about changes in behaviour? I mean, what about energy rationing? Do you think that will have to be brought in?
The idea of tradable energy quotients. Energy is going to be rationed by either price or by having tradable energy quotas. If it's rationed by price, the poorer people will suffer to a far greater extent than aiming, and it requires international action. There's no question about it. One country can't resolve this on their own. But you have only a limited number of ways of dealing with it. When you look at the numbers game in terms of alternative energies, they're all various partial solutions. It's not clear that they add up to a complete solution, and therefore you have to look at how you equitably deal with the fossil fuel provision that we have. And the tradable energy quotas is one way forward. The other one is pricing the poor people out of the market, which isn't very fair.
Well, absolutely not. But Matt Symonds, I mean, you're an expert on, you know, the impact this could have on the, on as it were, the global economy. It seems that pretty well any solution is going to have an impact on those at the bottom end of the scale.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that we basically can't let the market sort this out, because the market sorting it out is going to last for a few weeks, and then we have social chaos, and then we get into a resource war. What we really need to realize is that this is a global problem. It's not a UK problem. It's not a United States problem. It's not a California problem or a Texas problem. And that we're basically on the edge of scarcity of oil, which means we basically have to do a fast retreat from our heavy addiction to using oil. As Richard said, this is transportation. All the other forms of energy relate to electricity and heat, but this is transportation, so it's pretty simple. We have to travel less, and that means liberating the workforce, paying by productivity, ending long-distance commuting. Luckily, we have a toolkit we've already developed to be able to do that, but we now need to implement something that has the intensity of the war effort of World War II or the Manhattan Project or rebuilding Europe with do this all very fast in the next two or three years, or we've really lost the battle.
John Hemming, the scenario Matt's painting there does remind me very much of the war years. Not that I was in the war, but I've seen lots of documentaries about it. You know, people didn't travel very far. They lived very simple lives. They didn't have lots of expensive consumer durables. Is that the scenario we face?
Well, I think we need to focus more on quality of life rather than standard of living. And the evidence is people aren't necessarily happier in an environment where they commute 2 hours each day. Those factors need to be taken into account. And what is critical is we need to look at an equitable way of dealing with scarcity, and to just price the poor people out of the market, which is what the government are doing, isn't an equitable way of dealing with it.
Richard, what would you advise the UK government and other governments around the world?
Well, there already are grassroots efforts to transition away from fossil fuels, and I think the government should support communities that are looking for ways to build up public transport infrastructure to support local fossil fuel-free agriculture. These kinds of efforts are already happening, but they're more or less happening in the face of government, and government support could assist tremendously.
Final thoughts, gentlemen. John Hemming, what next?
Well, we really are at the stage where the government needs to move on from denial. The people can adjust their own lifestyle to be less energy dependent, and that's a strongly advisable thing to do, because we're not going to see over time a massive reduction in price, whatever happens. So it's in everybody's interest to adjust their lifestyle to minimise their use of energy.
To grasp the nettle, Matt Simmons.
We need to basically take a leaf out of the terrible tragedy the financial markets have been through the last 2 weeks and realize we have no audits, we have no reliable data on field-by-field production in most parts of the world. We have, and if we basically demanded real production data, I think within a matter of weeks, a high-level commission could actually prove that we have passed peak oil, and then we're going to panic and get about trying to fix the problem before we blow ourselves up. Pretty simple.
Richard?
What may be of even more concern is the fact that oil-exporting countries are seeing quickly growing domestic demand. In other words, Saudi Arabia, which is the world's foremost exporter, is seeing domestic demand for oil growing at 7% per year. It's doubling every 10 years. So that means that even though total world oil production has been pretty much flat for the past 4 years, we're already seeing declines in available net exports. And for countries that want to import oil, like the UK and the US, this is very serious news.
And do you see, I think Matt used the word chaos, do you see that?
Well, that could be the situation unless governments take this very seriously and start to plan for the inevitable decline in oil production.
Richard Heinberg, Max Simmons and John Hemming, thank you all very much.